And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Nietzsche is right about America being the land of opportunity. And maybe it yields has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, you know. But that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing as anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Okay, and we are live. Thank you very much for joining us. This is the Three Left Show. We have a technical difficulty with our headphones, so we don't really have the feedback. But I know that we're going out. I know that our audio is being picked up. So we're just going to have at it and then go from there.
All right.
Vern's station manager is going to work on it. He just got back to me. So anyway, so I'm Dan Platt. With me is Colin Abele.
Here I am.
And Isaac Hopp.
Hello.
So we are far left-wing political talk show of Albany, coming at you with news and analysis from a post-capitalist perspective. And that means we're socialists, we're anarchists, and we are for ecology. And that's the three lefts. So we're going to start with kind of a review from last week's episode or so. Not last week's, but the week before that. We were kind of doing a dive into the Ocasio-Cortez victory in Queens and going over the different reasons for an independent left party, the drawbacks and the reasons for, you know, that it's been done before, the party within a party strategy that we hear so much about, and also kind of maybe counterpunching the media blitz that she's been able to do and bringing up the standard of democratic socialism. Now there's all of these progressive Dems who are saying they too are democratic socialists. They just didn't know it before because they've never really thought about their ideology or what their actual ideas are.
No, it's just kind of a new buzzword. It's a new label that politicians are now willing to embrace. And the big news this past couple of weeks was that Democratic gubernatorial candidate and celebrity Cynthia Nixon was like, you know what? I'm a democratic socialist.
Especially since she received the DSA's endorsement.
Did she actually get it? I've got an article here from Politico.
Establishment.
The most recent one I could find. This is what I wanted to share with listeners. So the New York City DSA, Nixon went to DSA to seek their endorsement, and there were policy-based questions from the audience, I'm reading from the article, and then a discussion among the gathered members. At the end of the night, a straw poll was taken, so it's a straw poll, not an actual endorsement. And these were the results, with roughly a third of those present pushing for an endorsement, about a third pushing against an endorsement, and a third or so undecided. Which is a very interesting straw poll for me.
But like these are the people showing up to a meeting. They're more active.
Yes, these are more committed.
About these things a little more.
Yeah, committed DSA members. And you know, I think DSA is a decent organization. There's a lot of other lefties who kind of stomp down on it. They call them baby leftists. That's fine.
Everyone is immature in their outlook and part of education.
So to me, this says about a third.
Growth. I mean, I was there 8 years ago, about before Occupy. So if they're 22 or whatever, then it's like, well, that's where I was. I'm going to tell you what I learned in my 8 years more than I got than you, which is that Party Within a Party is really, it's one letdown after another. As I see Cortez, from the moment she won her primary and started going on TV, she walks back a lot of positions.
Yes.
She scrubs her website of certain planks.
Especially on Israel and Palestine.
It's getting some play on us, the radical left circles of, you know, like, well, so much for that. You know, it's like, look, if you can't say the Palestinians have human rights and stick with that. I mean, she says she was coming at, she just gave this waffly answer. And it's like, it was the answer you get after the, basically, Orthodox Jews of Queens come talk to you and say, we will fund Crowley, we will make sure he beats you in the general or something.
And it's,
even
that's possible
if he doesn't
too.
Want to.
That's possible, too, because Crowley is still going to be on the ballot in the November election, thanks to our
Why
good old
that?
Friends, our good friends at the Working Families Party. And a comrade of mine said it very well. We know that the Democratic Party is the graveyard of social movements. He described the Working Families Party as the grave diggers of social movements.
So I have a story to that effect. Joe Crowley's still running against Cortez as Working Families Party candidate by Steve Gundali from a site called Newsgrowl. And I did look at their about page as to who's behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a spinoff of a magazine produced by John F. Kennedy Jr., who's kind of an environmentalist activist guy. And their kind of a mission statement, just to be clear about that, is we deliver news and fashion from a neutral perspective. You know, they say it's kind of, they try to be apolitical. They kind of cover, they have a page that's just about the fashion choices of Beltway, like rising stars. But in between that, they actually do actual journalism, in my opinion. And it shows in that there's this, the last paragraph here is, so it goes over how, because, so the Working Families Party does fusion voting,
yes,
which is they endorse Democrats that they perceive or get, they want them to be as progressive as possible. So they say, you get our voter chunk, which could be the deciding 4% of election, because that's pretty much what it is. But that only matters if it's a close race. So it's assuming that all races are close. But thanks to gerrymandering,
there is no such thing as a close race.
So they're either endorsing Dems to quote-unquote make them take more left-wing positions, even when they don't really need to. And thus they do not need to be held to those promises, because then there's no actual consequence. They win in landslides anyway. Or it's like, then it is a close race, and it's like, well, we're not going to run our own candidate, and we're not going to endorse because that would be problematic for the Dem candidate, who needs to be moderate if they're going to win this red district. They're very pragmatic. You know, pragmatism is their go-to, and anyone who wants to do something different, like third party, they're like, you're not being pragmatic. You're going to ruin everything. And they work incessantly to sabotage their party efforts.
Yes.
Because it threatens their
They've definitely done that in the
strategies.
Past.
They've done Syracuse a lot. They run, you know, in primaries and Green Party candidates. The Working Family Party, created to take advantage of New York's highly unusual system of fusion voting, the Working Family Party typically endorses progressive Dems who in turn benefit from their ballot lines, so they say. Occasionally, they will run or threaten to run their own candidate, which is of little consequence. I voted for Working Family Party candidates in generals, and it just doesn't. They're like Green Party candidates as much as they get 5% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, how are you doing anything different than us? Only that you're able to endorse and get what they say, a seat at the table. I don't see much of the consequence of that, because it's just crumbs. So here's Crowley in the Cortez race. They did the pragmatic thing and endorsed Crowley because he was going to win. They're much like the voter who just wants to vote for the winner. I feel like they're on the winning side.
Very, very play it safe.
And so...
Well, surely I'll be able to influence them if I voted for them.
Yeah, that's such a... naive sentiment. I don't know. But yeah, that's the idea that's in a lot of people's heads. That a vote is influence. I mean, like, that I can call them and say, I voted for you, and I will not vote for you again if you don't do what I said.
Doesn't necessarily work that way.
It's very individualistic, and that's not how actual power works.
It's how
Unless
we're
you're rich.
It's how we're taught it works. It's what's been beaten into us since elementary school.
I think the assumption, tacit assumption, is that if you are rich, you are a vote that matters.
Yes,
because your vote is actually in dollars, not in
the
pulling of the proverbial lever, which is not a thing anymore, at least in New York. Okay, so last few paragraphs here. Live by fusion voting, die by fusion voting. So Crowley has a WFP line.
He'll be on the ballot in the
He'll
general
be on the
election.
Ballot. He doesn't want to be. Says he doesn't want to be. Isn't going to campaign.
But he's there.
Yeah, and companies like MSNBC have, well, not MSNBC, but NBC International donated to his campaign. Just learned this, as well as probably other corporations. As a party that concentrates its activities in states that allow fusion voting, the Working Family Party are not in the strongest position to complain when it goes wrong. If anything, the WFP should be grateful it does not go wrong more often. In March, it endorsed Duane Gregory in New York's 2nd Congressional District over a progressive candidate, Gretchen Shirley. Gretchen Shirley won the primary, but Gregory is, unlike Rowley, not currently listed as the WFP-endorsed candidate. Presumably, he has accepted a nomination for another office he does not want. But as in the case of Joe Crowley, relying on the goodwill of non-members to solve its problems is not a foolproof strategy. As long as the WFP resists endorsing candidates it agrees with, instead it tries to predict who will win the nomination, Democratic, expect this problem to continue.
Yeah, their guessing game kind of gets in the way of having any actual values.
They would say it's hard analysis that leads to a pragmatic decision.
Yeah. Because honestly, if the Working Families Party had any principles, they would have been behind Ocasio-Cortez straight from the beginning, because she's simply more progressive than Mr. Crowley. But they didn't think that she could win, so they go with the establishment candidate.
Yeah, and by the way, DSA has been behind Cortez, and that's one of the family of groups that actually helped her, have a strong grassroots campaign.
Right, and then Cynthia Nixon sees this and says, well, if I describe myself, I need all the help I can get. I mean, she couldn't even get the automatic ballot line at the state convention. She got something like a paltry 1 or 2% to get on the ballot line. The Democratic Party just didn't want her there, so she's having trouble even getting on the ballot. She has to do it through petitioning.
Petitioning.
So obviously she wants a lot of these young, enthusiastic, energetic Democratic Socialists of America to help.
Yeah, you don't have to do the petitioning if you go to the party directly.
That's correct. Yeah. And they vote to say, yes, let's have a contested primary. No, the New York State Democrats are just solidly lockstep behind Andrew Cuomo. Nobody wants to cheese him off at all.
They want to be on the winning side,
They want to be on the winning side,
just
too.
Just a pragmatic, sensible thing to do.
So now we're seeing Cynthia Nixon is like the first major politician to do this in such a large race, right? New York State Governor's Office, one of the most powerful positions in the USA. She comes out and just says, I'm a Democratic Socialist. And automatically, you see, about a third of DSA memberships are like, well, yeah, sure. You call yourself that, you got our back. Another third are non-committed, which means they're wondering, does she really mean it? Do I have enough political education to even understand what this means? Mm-hmm. But another third, I'm sure, in DSA are what I would call good comrades who see straight through this maneuver and say, this is the first time Ms. Nixon is describing herself like this. This is just to appease us.
She's changing with the wind.
She's changing with the winds, yes.
And she won't be the last Democrat to do
this. I expect to see more of this.
And it freaks out Fox News and those buzzards more and more. The Red Scare this, Red Scare that.
Oh, MSNBC pulls the same Red Scare stuff as well. I remember watching them all during the 2016 presidential race.
The Russia Maddow show.
Yeah, right now it's the Russia Maddow show. But the worst offender, I think, was their flagship guy, Hardball, Chris Matthews.
Yeah.
And he was red baiting Bernie Sanders like a madman.
He's done it his entire career, though. Like, he was calling Phil Donahue, anyone who was against the Iraq War, like, unpatriotic, traitor. That's the standard fascist line. Anyone who's an outsider or for pacifism or just anti-war,
they are
a traitor.
I don't see how anybody can call themselves a progressive and still watch that station at all. It's so middle of the road and so red baiting.
Well,
don't waste your time.
If TV is your main source of news, then that is where you go. So obviously you want to listen to the radio, and you want to go to podcasts and YouTube.
Yes,
which although is the internet is now is entirely commercialized, is at least not so dominated and oligarchic.
The problem is,
at least the sites are oligarchic, I guess. But the
choice is stark, right? Mm-hmm. Using the internet to find your own information is a much better choice. You will get better information, but it's an active choice, right? Mm-hmm. Watching the cable news is a passive choice. You just turn on the clicker, and the programming is decided for you. Mm-hmm. When you go on the internet and there's this empty Google search engine thing, you're like, well,
I don't know what to search
for. I don't even know what to search for. I guess
I don't
What
do I want?
I guess I'll search for socialism.
Important questions.
And then you'll get just as many bad hits as good. And someone's search could end in one day when they find some, what's the guy's name? Jordan Peterson nonsense.
Crowder, you know, right wingers.
Yeah, Drudge Report.
And then it's like, oh, this guy is articulate enough and he's saying things that I agree with.
Yeah,
sometimes.
You run into Turning Points USA propaganda.
I believe in freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So back to what just happened. I'm going to keep my eye out for... I might be a little behind on this. I heard that... Did Cynthia Nixon actually get Democratic Socialists of America endorsement, or are they still in the process of deciding whether or not to do that?
You were searching for that, weren't you?
I couldn't find anything definitive. The most I found was from a political article about a couple weeks ago with that straw poll.
Yeah. So continuing our kind of first few sections where we are continuing kind of a discussion of electoral politics. And I have a story here that exemplifies the unfairness of our system. People have a sense of how unfair our democracy is. That's obviously not just giving people a voice because of a flood of money, but just that there's more to be a structuralist, other things at play, even besides the money. But, of course, the money it's still a follow-the-money kind of game here. But so it's a simple question by the same website, NewsGrowl. NewsGrowl.
Growl.
Yeah.
Like a dog.
Why do pollsters ignore New York governor candidates Larry Sharp, Libertarian, and Howie Hawkins, Green?
Good old Howie.
Mm-hmm. The person who should actually get the DSA endorsement.
If anybody, for sure.
The
person who's been a Democratic socialist.
A union organizer.
A member of the Socialist Party.
Yes. He's my guy, for sure. So, on November 6th, New Yorkers will choose their governor using ballots with at least four options on them. Two of those options, Green Party candidate Howie Hawkins, Larry Sharp said that. Yet, reputable polling firms like Siena, Marist, and Quinnipiac, so these are the people in New York who do polling.
Those are the big three.
So, and you can just fill those names in with the bigger names in the national scale. This definitely scales up. Restrict the choices of the respondents to just two major parties, ignoring the disconnect between the question they ask in the polls and the questions voters will ultimately answer in the voting group. We wanted to know why. Sensible journalistic thing to do?
Good question. Like, four candidates, why do they only ask about two?
So we contacted all three organizations. Two of them replied, but not with the answers we were expecting. So first, so then they cover about how Hawkins and Sharp are, as they put it, unusually strong third-party candidates. This is because Howie has, this is his third time running, so he's developed more of a rapport, experience campaigning. Obviously, he's done so a lot more. His lieutenant governor is Jaya Lee, a radical teaching teacher organizer in New York.
There's also a lot of progressives that are just done with Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah, mostly the activist base, I would call them.
Who are ready and eager probably to cast a ballot for Howie Hawkins after seeing him on the ballot a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
But continue.
Much of the media attention for the governor's race has been focused on Sex and the City star Cynthia Nixon and Governor Andrew Cuomo's reaction to having a celebrity competitor. Far away from the glare of the cameras, however, the Libertarians and Greens have been quietly mounting what may be one of the New York's best ever election results for third-party candidates. Hawkins received 4.8% of the vote when he ran for governor back in 2014. He is running again in 2018, his third attempt, and thanks to his increased name. Larry Sharp is a true rock star for libertarians.
I'm sure they love him.
And is widely considered the strongest candidate the party is fielding in any race across the country. And aside, there was a group of Republicans who wanted to make him the Republican nominee,
yeah.
They failed to do that. They were outvoted, I guess. But otherwise, there was an effort to do that since he is still better than any Republican who would be nominated.
I don't even know what Republican.
No, none of them want to. He stunned the New York political establishment in January when he reported contributions were over six times that of the declared Republican in the race.
So he's got the money.
Charismatic and tireless, the former Marine is proving to be a formidable campaigner. And yet major polling organizations repeatedly ignore both Hawkins and Sharp in every poll they produce. Media tend to report on candidates doing well in the polls, so being consistently frozen out is a huge frustration for both campaigns. The Sharp campaign recently collected $5,000 from donors to commission its own poll with a marketing company. Although not a household name, Gravis is a reputable polling firm, and is one of the 19 organizations tracked by 538. The poll found that in a five-way race that included Sharp and Hawkins, they both polled around 5%. The Gravis poll had a 4% margin of error, though. It's very large. Which means the Libertarian Green votes could be significantly smaller. Not likely. But the poll also found that among voters, or they could be a lot larger as well, who knew who Sharp was, his vote jumped to an impressive 24%. And Hawkins' share rose to 7. It's odd.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. To the Sharp campaign, the message is clear. The more voters who know about Larry, the better he does. And by the way, so this is a poll commissioned by them. So
yes.
I think something in the framing, because if you've taken any stats class, which many of us haven't.
Yeah, which is not cheap to do. Campaigns do their own internal polling.
Oh, yeah.
And often keep the results to themselves they are pretty
good.
It says
$5,000, right?
Yeah.
So $5,000. That's for like this basic, they called 500 people.
So props to them for even including Howie Hawkins. They could have done the crappy thing and mm-hmm. not even included. So
yeah.
Write this down on your calendars. This is me, a socialist,
are
saying.
Fair enough. I mean, they're not fair economically.
Fair enough.
They're fair in some principles.
You know?
And
having them
since they're
there,
underdogs too.
Having them there, it only splits the right. So good on them for keeping things.
Once they have power, different story.
Yes,
I think it would be between Sharp and Hawkins. A 10% share of overall vote is conservatively a real possibility. This could have an enormous impact on the final result, the ultimately determine who's sworn in. News Growl contacted 3 widely respected pollsters to cover the New York gubernatorial race, Mara, Siena, Quinnipiac, again.
Those are the
thanks
three.
To them, and asked the same 3 questions. 1, why are you leaving them out of your polls? 2, as a respected polling, so respectability politics in play here, respected polling organization, what would you say to the allegation that by leaving Sharp and Hawkins out of your polls, you're weakening their legitimacy to voters and therefore influencing the outcome of the election?
Yes.
Almost like,
well,
Russia. three, this is why I'm not, like, it seems like on Facebook there's 2 camps. You're a puppet Putin or a security state puppet. Anyway.
We need a radical middle.
Radical centrists. They exist. Why do you think polling organizations of similar reputations in other countries, Canada, UK, Germany, include parties of similar size to New York Green and Libertarian parties in their polls?
It's a very important question. That
they're also a parliamentarian system, but
yes, completely
we
different
could
system.
Be more like it. That. We were not entirely sure what to expect. We were not even sure if we would get any replies. We assumed if we did, they would include technical justifications for excluding third-party candidates.
They wanted to see some statistics. They wanted mathematical.
Which, by
answers.
The way, is what the League of Women Voters does on the national and state level. They use technicalities and basically actually make up rules that aren't there. They use rules that don't exist. or they're just interpreting the rule in a way that allows them not to.
So what were the answers?
Well, we could not have been more wrong. And as far as we can interpret them, it appears the two groups generally ignore third-party candidates just because they want to.
So while I read this article, I was like, these are all the answers that they give. And when they give them, it is so obviously and blatantly a lie that it just fills me with rage. Like, these are, go ahead and read them, but I'm going to be sitting here in my chair just seething, being okay. Like, I know why.
Picture it.
I know why they're
picture
not.
Picture it, listeners.
Yeah.
Replying to the, okay, what Sienna said. Da, 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 da. Replying to the record, Siena College Research Institute spokesman Steven Greenberg, and by the way, Siena is local here in Albany. Hawkins and Sharp have been left out of Siena's recent June 4th to 7th poll because, well, because they're not Republicans or Democrats. We only did head-to-head Democrat versus Republican matchups, as the rest of the ballot is still in flux, they said in an email. We questioned Greenberg about his use of the word flux. In fact, so this is a journalist not just taking their word for it, but also interpreting the rest of society and what's going on.
This influx thing is nonsense.
Yes, and using a more generous, I would call rational, interpretation of reality. Okay, so use of the word flux. In fact, both ballot lines arguably least in flux are the Libertarian and Green Party lines.
Yeah.
Both Sharp and Hawkins are already the official nominees of their parties.
They're there.
Unlike Cuomo and Nixon and Maliero, I guess that's the Republican.
Whoever that is.
All of whom Sienna did include. Thanks to Hawkins' strong showing in 2010 and 2014, getting more than 5%, the Green Party has an automatic ballot access.
All right,
we need 50,000 and we got 150,000. If it was 70,000 the first time and then 150,000 votes the second time. So we doubled the amount of votes. And if we're trying to do that again, I don't think we're going to make it, especially since he's polling at the same 5%. And actually,
it'll probably go up.
Yeah,
that's my
prediction. Towards after the primaries, his polling was 9% and he got 5%.
Yeah.
Neither Republican or the Democrat nominees will formally chosen until September 13th. Many GOP members, with front-runner Mark Milano there, may still be a surprise in store. Never mind that. Cynthia Nixon is struggling to even qualify for the ballot in the Democratic primary. She's currently collecting petitions. Maybe that's finished by now.
So as I was saying earlier.
And may or may not be on the Working Family Party ballot line as well.
That's in flux.
That's in flux.
Howie Hawkins on the Green Party line and Larry Sharp on the Libertarians is a sure thing. This Siena research guy is lying through his teeth. Mm-hmm. And he's taking advantage of a common misconception about third-party politics in America, which is we're all chickens running with our heads cut off, right?
Or politics in general.
Unorganized.
We don't even have to limit it to third-party and us, radicals. It is all those independents, all those open-minded people who vote for a candidate, based on who they are, and it's not, I don't vote for party. I take them at their word. They want to discuss and deliberate over each individual candidate. Really inefficient in my view, but whatever, their prerogative. But they need the information. It needs to be there.
Yeah.
Right. We can't have a conversation with everyone to suggest they go to the website. And at least debate candidates, which, by the way, they're not going to be included in the debates either.
Not this year. They were last year.
But I think I saw the headline that the debate running organization, which is League of Women Voters.
And this is a problem.
Aren't going to include them.
Polls.
Or they're thinking about not including them.
Polls and debates are two important sources of information for voters. Right. This was the premise of this article.
Again, people determine who they vote for based on, not all, some, who's winning. And they want at least there to be a chance that their vote matters.
Yeah, because they think...
So if someone's polling 5%, sorry, go on.
They think if they vote for the loser, their vote has been wasted. Mm-hmm. Even if that loser gets 49%.
Because now they can't call the politician with the confidence that I voted for you.
Yeah.
Going back to that sentiment of,
but as I
my
said,
vote is
two major sources of information. So voters get their get their information mainly from the mainstream news media. And the mainstream news media uses polls and debates to just let people know who's running in the first place. Like, and if you don't know who's running, you can't make up your mind by the time you go into the voting booth. And then you'll see a guy whose name you've never seen before or heard before. You're not going to vote for them because you're uninformed. And that's what the mainstream media and these polling agencies are doing. They're not in the business of informing people about what choices you have. They're in the business of telling you, here's your Democrat, here's your Republican. That is the illusion of choice.
So Greenberg answered our remaining two questions succinctly and without elaboration to the question of whether leaving them out weakens their legitimacy. He said, absolutely not.
See, that's another bold-faced lie. Of course it does.
And regarding postals in other countries, he said, that's their decision to make.
No.
What Morris said. So we've covered Siena, now Morris. So far this cycle, Morris has only pulled the Democratic primary race and not the general election. Although they have a track record of ignoring third-party candidates in the past, it would be inaccurate to say Morris has left Larry Sharp and Howie Hawkins out of their 2018 polls yet. Still, they were kind enough to send us a general response to our inquiry without addressing individual questions separately. This is their quote. When the Morris poll asks a general election question, we include ballot status candidates. In instances where we poll with a media partner, candidate inclusion is determined at the discretion of the media partner.
The gatekeepers, basically.
The media oligarch conglomerates.
The for-profit.
Okay, that's who we're talking about.
Capitalist media. They don't want you, that capitalist media wants.
They don't want you to know the truth, man.
They don't want you to know the truth. No, they want to keep people in the dark. They want to keep on presenting the fact that we are a two-party country when in fact we are a single-party dictatorship of capitalism. And that helps by only telling people about the Democratic and Republican candidates for public office. That gives them the illusion of choice when in fact they have no choice. Both those political parties are simply bureaucratic overseas of the dictatorship
and
of capital.
And their private organizations.
Yes.
So if they're hacked, it's the same as Sony getting hacked. It's not like a war crime.
So, I mean, I'll give it to Marist here. They're at least being a little bit honest. Like,
about, you know, why?
We would include these guys, but the capitalist media says don't do it.
It's the money, Lebowski.
Yep.
So they say as much as well, but to drive the point home, if Marist has media partners, NBC4 of New York and the Wall Street Journal, and was forced, presumably kicking and screaming, to drop any mention of Hawkins by name from the poll, respondents were not even given the option for other. The only choices were Democrat Andrew Cuomo and several possible Republican candidates, Rob Astorino, Carlo Palladino, or Donald Trump. Yes, that's right. Because he was a possible candidate for the New York gubernatorial race in 2020.
Well, he was just, I mean.
But that was, well, he thought he was a joke candidate. This time.
And this goes to hammer the point home that this Donald Trump stuff is the media's fault. Right. Donald Trump, they kept on asking about him. They were like, oh, wouldn't this be fun, right? So they kept on asking about him.
It wasn't a matter of fun. It was a matter of profit.
It was a matter of, yeah.
It was
because
making the money, they figured asking people about Trump.
Yeah,
because it was not
scandalous, but it was a spectacle. It was, you
That's
know,
right.
it was drama.
Yeah.
It got people
it's
tuned
a great
in
show.
And paying
America,
people.
America,
right.
The show.
People are tuned in and paying attention, and that means advertising revenue, and that means asking about complete buffoons. And I mean, Cynthia Nixon is kind of a part of this phenomenon, the celebrity politician that is new. I expect to see a lot more celebrities declare for public office and then automatically get media coverage and asked about in polls just for simply floating the idea.
So let's I'll wrap up here. We also spotted what appeared to be the first contradiction in Morris's policy of only including candidates with confirmed ballot access. In their recent Democratic primary race, released on April 12th, Morris asked respondents if they would vote for Cuomo, Nixon, or were undecided. Nixon's place on the Democratic primary ballot wasn't confirmed, however.
That's right.
A month after this poll was published, he actually failed to get enough delegate votes, so we've mentioned that.
Yep.
As Morris' policy is to only include candidates with ballot status. Why did they include Nixon? Simple question.
And I love their response.
Oh, yeah. So this is their clarification. Regarding primaries, this would be a news judgment. A primary toss-up may be measured without all petitions being in if there is thought to be news value at the time. And news value is money value.
Use value.
There's no contradiction.
If it's a use value to the media corporation.
So keep that in mind when you listen to for-profit media. Now, and the article wraps up with a very nice point that by ignoring third party and other candidates and all the options, you are in essence ignoring the voters themselves. And thus, feeling ignored, they do something insensible, mm-hmm. like elect Donald Trump. But he didn't even get a popular vote. But let's just say having the popular vote in enough states to have the electoral college.
Well, I just love the fact that only two out of three, so Quinnipiac, right? They didn't even respond. They were like, we're not even going to dignify
this. But assume they're the same. They are the same. Because I remember a different article from years back in 2014, I believe, that was covering, I think it was just Quinnipiac. And basically, and this kind of puts the pressure for them to actually do these polls, and maybe they'll do one poll either right before the primary.
Like right before the primary, or right before the general election.
Yes, right before.
And then people, but by then the damage is done, because you ask the people being polled, what about this Green Party guy? What about this Libertarian guy? They're like, huh? Who? I haven't heard of him before. And so they're not going to say that they're going to vote for him. And then that
people need to think about something like voting for a few weeks at least. I think there is some science.
Well, I mean, you've got people like us who pay attention to politics year round and are active in it as a hobby and as a thing that we do. And then you've got your average American voter who doesn't even realize that election day is coming up until it's November 1st or something like that. And then the news.
Or they start seeing campaign ads.
Or they start seeing campaign ads, yeah.
Well, both of those things have a lot to do with the length of the campaign season. Like, campaigns really start 2 years before the election.
That's true.
To raise the money and to get volunteer base.
And get your name out there through the mainstream media.
Yeah.
We're already starting to hear.
By the time election day actually comes around, you know, people are overwhelmed.
The battle is decided.
And yet also forgotten that it's actually coming up.
Yeah. The battle is decided in the preparation, as Sun Tzu would say.
Yes.
So in this the last third, we'll shift away from electoral politics. We think we talked about that.
Yeah, I can
that.
Only focus on electoral politics.
We had something else to get mad about. So to finish, this segment will be related to local news. We had a recent spike in violence, a few shootings. Basically, we've had 8 homicides this year, and
that's quite a bit. That's quite a bit for a city this size.
A dozen wounded. Yeah, we're a small, mid-sized city, 100,000 people. But we have a lot of drug trade come through here.
Yes, that's the halfway point between New York City and Montreal, mm-hmm. and between Boston and Buffalo.
Right.
This place is
a good crossroads.
Right in the middle.
We're a strategic point going back to colonial times. So where to start? I didn't bring up everything at once, but we'll start with how I'm going to go with this. Excuse me for a moment. So, various community reactions. I think the conversation is a little restricted because of we've had machine politics a long time.
Yes.
And a police force that historically has been oppressive to minority communities, usually mostly made up of, and still is, but it's been a shift in policy in the last few years with the new mayor, Mayor Sheehan. That we actually hire people who live in Albany.
Albany police.
So the ranks of the amount of Albany police who actually live in the city and are invested in the communities, by socially speaking, is growing. Still a minority, but at least growing. But meanwhile, police are still police. And I want to state firsthand that the issue is complicated as far as the source of violence and crime is poverty. Say that from the outset.
Yep.
But when it comes to the voter base or the community, wholesale speaking, there's some religion. So the source of crime is, you know, inherent nature.
Oh, it's because we're godless, this and that, or because of the problem of evil.
We need to go to church more. Sometimes it comes out.
The fall of man.
Are those really things that come up in discussion about violence here?
Definitely not directly. But there's a religious character, like the pastors will speak more than others.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly puts me off. But again, this is a complicated issue. I'm just bringing up like stream of consciousness stuff as far as I'm concerned. So I can turn to something a little more concrete.
Well, some people think the cause of violence is,
okay,
being around at nighttime.
I won't cite things directly, but I guess in the show notes, I will be putting in a bunch of Facebook links. The police are overextended. So their budget is $55 million, give or take.
$55 million.
Or it's between $50 and $55 million. So maybe it's $52. I need to look at what the exact annual budget was this year. When I ran for mayor last year, it was like $52.
Well, it's 55 some odd million dollars, and they want more.
And that's a third of the city's budget, by the way.
This is like the classic liberal response to any problem.
More police.
Throw money at it.
Now
spend more.
Now the police force in general. Now there's the leadership, and there's the rank and file because they are unionized, and they're in a union dispute with the mayor. So they have some demands. Like part of it is Colony has our suburb has drones and they don't.
They want drones.
They get their armored vehicles, but they also they're saying their vests aren't fitted.
No.
They're fast. They're bulletproof vests.
Too tight.
Because I've never...
No, but so, they want all the toys that other militarized police departments get.
The vice union president of the police officers union put out a statement. It was a Facebook post, but it was a PR move.
This is the one that got him kind of in trouble.
Blaming the mayor for the violence by underfunding them. It was a list of grievances. And it threw shade at the grassroots programs that are run, managed, and for people of color.
Yeah, this is the one that was kind of full of a couple of racist dog whistle phrases, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the police chief, acting police chief, apparently, basically ordered him to take it down, apologize, and tried to do some damage control because these mothers do not understand how, like, the city is a bit divided. I'm going to be very blunt. There's a white half that's property owners, and they're progressives in name. But it's like there's these two buttons, and they can only push one. And it's progressive values or property values.
Mm-hmm.
And crime and drug trade lower property values. So, and shootings or whatever, and poor people. So, and so they usually click the property values first, and that means more police. Progressive values would be spending on social programs and more of these grassroots programs. But I tried working with the group Cure Violence, which a project of Trinity Alliance, and it's a on-the-ground intervention team where they have informers on the ground in the hoods, and when it looks like trouble is brewing between gangs, they have informers, and then they have former gang members intervene who know what they're doing more so than cops do.
Yeah.
And they're not armed because it's not an armed confrontation.
And
it's about defusing.
They're from the community.
So it's less sexy, all right? Because if you're coming at this with a war on crime mentality, then you are glorifying the conflict.
Yes.
War has casualties.
It creates soldiers out of police, essentially.
In fact, this year, it's been 8 plus 13 wounded casualties. That's the way I'm like kind of looking at it. It's like, look, if the richer half of Albany, middle class half, because no one's really that rich, but at least middle class, and can say that with confidence, I lost it. But I mean, if it's like we gotta fight the crime, and then it's war, making war, and that's what the police.
Yes, the
do.
Language that
now,
we use.
We try our
is
best
important.
To be a national standard for community policing. You know, the mayor went to Washington.
Well.
To promote community policing, our community policing. We have the LEAVE program, which is a deferment. Like if you're a drug addict, we send you to the hospital and not the jail. Don't know the numbers on that yet. It just started 2 years ago. And this was, and all of these things are for the work of almost radical activists or the radical activists that compromise by working with the system, by trying to get a nicer police force and not try to abolish it. So the chief comes out, tries to clean this up.
Damage control.
But then the rest of the union puts out a statement supporting Officer McGee, the first officer.
Right. So
saying, no, we do agree the vests don't fit. And we do have grievances. And we are, you know, we're 10 short. They have 10 vacancies for officers. And we can't hire those people because of a spending freeze, basically. That this was because of austerity politics.
I think it's just ludicrous, though, to think that if there were 10 more police, would there be 8 fewer homicides? You know, police respond to violence after the fact.
The argument they would make, just to play that devil's advocate thing, is that, you know, if we have more people patrolling, and they patrol in cars mostly, by the way, there are the community officers that are on the ground, and they actually, like, pop into places and whatever, and I see them now and then, and they kind of know when to keep their mouth shut and state their opinion only when asked, which is always an authoritarian one. We need to do more of this. We need to, like, you know, get rid of the undesirables. It always kind of comes down to that. You know, they call teenagers cockroaches. One of them did. They're actually not very nice people. They talk about how, like, oh, kids need to be beaten more, set straight, like I was. Not naming any names. Angels were coming in to kind of show off their program. They're problematic old white dudes, but they are a community grassroots program replacing the police. So I have mixed feelings.
Explain more about who the Guardian Angels are. I haven't heard that much about them.
So they had an effort to establish a chapter in Albany in the 80s. They started in the 70s as a response to the crime crisis. It was way worse then than it is now. And the police were completely ineffective and corrupt, more so than now, if you can believe it. So something needed to be done. So this is mostly like some Italian guys from the Italian hood, and they started their own little kind of militia. It's kind of like community militia.
Okay.
A more aggressive neighborhood watch, but they are de-escalators first. When they intervene, they're de-escalating. And I don't think they're armed themselves, but they train. They're the tough guys, you know. At least they have a presence that you're not going to push them around, kind of that kind of thing. But without being overtly, it's not. I think there's a tinge of toxic masculinity there. I don't know. I think that's the sense of the criticism.
Whereas with police, they definitely go into escalate. They're definitely armed, and they're certainly infected by toxic masculinity.
This is not always the case. The APD, but it's a matter of, like, half have been trained in de-escalation.
Well, is it?
And I've seen them do it.
Okay, if the Guardian Angels are actually mediators, is there a way to contact them when you need mediation?
Good question.
Or
I don't know.
Do they patrol, or
they
just
patrol,
take
and
emails? Or
they must. They must have a line. I can't imagine they wouldn't, but who knows? I mean, they started before cell phones and walkie-talkies. So I don't know their ways. I'm really just, the point is there was a lot of pushback against them because they're outsiders. Now, they do have some interested people, so there might actually be a chapter forming.
Are they outsiders? Like, are they visiting from another city, or are they a chapter who lives here?
They're New York City.
Okay.
But they're trying to start a chapter, so it's like it wouldn't be outsiders doing it.
Yeah,
they were here.
I mean, you
got to
train
demo.
People eventually.
They demonstrated. They had a rally on in one of the hoods to demonstrate what they do and to talk about. They had it was like a teach-in, and then they actually did intervene, and it was very, what do you call it? It was a spectacle where they intervened with an arguing couple, and it kind of like. You get a lot of people like, well, you know, you don't know if it's actually trouble or a domestic dispute that could turn violent. But the point is, you kind of intervene to make sure it doesn't, and you do it in a way where it's like, okay, you don't want us around, we'll back off, kind of way. I don't know. Maybe part of the problem is that they don't back off when asked to.
That's
up to individual chapters, too. I mean, obviously, we all need to learn more of these skills of de-escalation, of facilitation.
Yeah, we definitely do.
Mediation. Only lawyers can take a class when they go to law school for mediation and get a certificate. I think I wish that was kind of more available. I feel like there must be some workshop where you can learn mediation skills, just as when it comes to direct democracy, consensus, that there are trainers, you pay a few $100.
There's a place called Mediation Matters in Albany that our party, the Socialist Party, has reached out to just for mediation training for us internally.
Yeah.
Mediation Matters would be their name.
Yeah, they got back to
I actually reached out to them for an issue I was having with some neighbors. I can't afford their services. And so I'm
I'm
trying to figure out if there is a middle ground. Maybe less trained mediators that you can access for free.
One of my planks is when I ran for mayor was accessible mediation as a alternative to calling the police. Like when you dial 911, imagine if one of the options was mediation hotline.
I'm having an argument here. We're both angry.
Yeah, send the mediator.
Woo, woo.
It's like, all right, everybody, let's sit down at a table.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least...
I brought coffee and donuts.
Yeah. I brought cake. Let's all sit down and have some cake. Yeah. But, I mean, I saw the police do this once. They actually did de-escalate by getting between. And they weren't able to mediate what the conflict was, but... People just need to cool off.
Yes.
And that just means separation. And the police can do that and have. And a third of them have been trained to do this. So it's not.
Which leaves a majority without that training.
A third of the police have been trained in.
I don't have the exact stat in front of me. But it's I've taken in some stats based on what the city puts out. And I believe it's between a third. And a half have been trained.
Why are they all
jerks?
Like, no. And so why aren't all the police being trained in?
Well, it costs money. Money that the city doesn't have.
You know what? So.
But that doesn't go into there.
So does the rest of the police training.
Because New York isn't really not a social democracy.
Notice though, when the police union is saying we are underfunded, even though we're at $55 million. They're not saying we need this money for mediation training. They're saying we need more vests that fit. We need more cars. We probably need more guns. They're asking
more
for
military equipment.
Yeah, they're asking for things in terms of the war on drugs and the war on crime. This goes to show that the police, as an institution, they're not there to solve problems, right? They're there to keep down uprisings. They're there to solve problems for one particular class of people, and it's your bourgeoisie.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you said all this crime, the cause of this crime is poverty, which itself is violence against people, right? Keeping them from the things that they need in order to live a comfortable, meaningful life.
That's what we mean by structural violence.
That's the structural violence that then the community lashes out with. You know, that's what gives you these drug wars because it's for resources.
It's like a small scale riot.
Yeah, if you can't get a job because racists won't hire you, or because there just aren't that many jobs available, you're going to turn to something else, and then the police are going to then they've got their excuse to then bring you in and imprison you, and then force you to labor and pay you 3 cents an hour.
You can't. So, with that, we finish our first hour.
That's our first hour.
Yeah.
So the second hour here.
We're shifting gears a bit. Hmm? Shifting gears a little bit.
Yes. We're going to have a completely different kind of set of topics as the second hour we usually try to be. And we're going to talk mental health system and mental health issues and ableism. So first, we're going to have a story, two stories, which is about how anti-authoritarians are diagnosed as mentally ill. And that, so kind of a statement of the problem, at least for us radicals. So the first kind of point is that psychiatry is a profession, like all professions, have a authoritarian bent to them by the very ethic of how these institutions operate, that there's a control of knowledge, control of positions.
Well, and how the research is done.
Strict
hierarchy.
I mean,
only experts can do the research. And only a certain interpretation of the information is considered valid.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very strict hierarchy. And this is the case with all professions. So professionalism is a very anti-populist type of thing. And, of course, there's not saying that to expertise is not invaluable, but it's just that to be an expert is to have more power than others, and power is to restrict others' options, which is lack of freedom and so on, liberty and all that. So the article goes through some examples of a few famous people, at least. I think the main example is Albert Einstein, who was... Can you go down to that?
Albert Einstein as a youth would likely have received an ADHD diagnosis and maybe an ODD one as well. Albert didn't pay attention to his teachers, failed his college entrance examinations twice, and had difficulty holding jobs. However, Einstein biographer Ronald Clark asserts that Albert's problems did not stem from attention deficits, but rather from his hatred of authoritarian Prussian discipline in his schools. Einstein said, "The teachers in his elementary school appeared to me like sergeants, and in the gymnasium, teachers were like lieutenants." At age 13, Einstein read Kant's Difficult Critique of Pure Reason, because Albert was interested in it. Clark also tells us Einstein refused to prepare himself for his college admissions as a rebellion against his father's unbearable path of a practical profession. After he did enter college, one professor told Einstein, "You have one fault. One can't tell you anything." The very characteristics of Einstein that upset authorities so much were exactly the ones that allowed him to excel.
Reminds me of those Apple Think Different campaigns where they have these trailblazers who were, what do they all have in common? They weren't authoritarian.
Well, okay, so...
But anyway, you go on.
I'd like to make this point. There's a distinction in how opposition is treated for people in positions of privilege, like Albert Einstein and Saul Alinsky, which the author describes here, and marginalized people, because historically, for women, for black men, for more outwardly disabled, like neurodiverse or mentally ill people, punishments are much more severe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and yet, these are often also the traits that generate our creativity and competence, but it's not recognized as such.
Mm-hmm. Not recognized by market labor system.
Right. We are not offered the opportunities to make use of the unique skills that we have, unless we're in positions of privilege, like Albert Einstein, Saul Alinsky, and all the...
And it's the case that if you say the liberal argument is opportunities, like, okay, you know, the opportunity to be profitable for someone, to have your labor exploited, the opportunity to make someone else money, or to make yourself money as an entrepreneur, let's say. So is it that, you know, these skills that the neurodiverse, those that, say, don't take orders well, who, and this is something the article points out, there are kids that just don't like following orders by some trait, or because maybe their parents are less conformist, like my own.
Oh, I don't even think it's that. I, literally it's the pushback against the very rigid hierarchical society. It's not even a matter of the kids' actual traits or the parents raising them.
What you're talking about, the marginalized. Yeah, the marginalized pushback, and that's classified as being not right.
Yeah.
And they must be crazy. Yeah. And something wrong with them they oppose our perfect enlightened rational system.
Right. I mean, like, this literally goes back to the Inquisition. That was entirely about, you know, crushing defiance and differences that were inconvenient. Mm-hmm. So
that goes for all fascism.
Right.
The kind of article wraps up in the last paragraphs about kind of that psychiatry, the mental health system, is kind of a tool and about, like most institutions, maintenance of a status quo.
Yes.
Right.
And so anyone who doesn't fit in it is then undesirable. Caste systems have some undesirable class.
Yeah. This is a very Foucauldian analysis, right?
It is. I mean, he literally wrote about it. Yeah.
Civilization and madness is the work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in terms of what Foucault called biopolitics, monitoring lifetime, and weeding out undesirables who are more difficult. When it comes to the capitalist class, they want nice, disciplined workers who follow orders because in terms of lifetime, you don't want to be spending...
That's what our system needs.
Yes, as the ruler giving the orders, you don't want to be spending your time giving the same orders twice, right? Don't make me say this twice, just... give the order and then go do it. Well, if you're an anti-authoritarian, or if you're just, you know, open-minded enough to know that blindly following orders could cause an ethical dilemma,
or if you struggle to understand the instructions as given,
I mean, if there is any kind of ethical dilemma, capitalism doesn't have time for the worker to stand back and say, is this the right or wrong thing to do? No, they want you to just get to work and do it. You know
most
what I mean?
Most parents are trained in this way. We're all by default trained to think.
Right. That's how the mode of production, capitalism, influences cultural norms, like how children are raised, how children are taught, how workers are trained, you know, right on through to the
and
end
thus,
of old
if
age.
If the economy is disrupted, it's a big panic.
Right, because time is money. This is one of the issues of modernity.
And I'm not just talking about Tech Valley disruption. I'm talking about some natural disaster, a drought, something that disrupts the supply chain. Let's say there's an oil embargo that, you know, created a lot of problems, creates economic crashes, and we'll have something like that soon enough.
In the end, people who are determined to be neurodivergent, have mental illnesses, are disabled. The main thing, disabled means you're not able to work properly enough for someone to extract value from your labor.
I mean, it literally just means that you don't have the resources that you need to manage your situation, whatever it is. Like, there was an article going around yesterday about marathoners in London passing out in 70, 76 something. Nope. To us, it was barely warm. But for them, they're not acclimated to...
Okay, so you're just talking about the context of different...
Yeah, and that's kind of if... So a disability can be anything. We've defined things, such arbitrary things as disabilities.
Standard is your worker who is pretty much a robot and can work as long as you want and does and so on and follows commands and... That's the standard, right?
Yeah, and
to be really basic about it, whether it's workfare or social programs or any employer, it's like, do you show up on time? Do you, you know, if I give you direction, will you follow it? So on and so forth. I mean, there are businesses where it's like, we work as a team. We make decisions collaboratively. That can be around too, But they operate within a market system where profitability is still the driving factor of everything. And so even if you try to be the best possible boss or the best possible workplace,
now you're still in competition with all the people who don't do all those nice things.
It's a disadvantage.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, co-op growth is slow in America. And it may not be, I mean, to talk about them and try to promote them is a worthwhile endeavor. But it's still like, I don't think it's going to be enough unless the co-op economy can actually be a dual power, which means there needs to be a lot more of them. And co-ops need to trade with just co-ops. You only need to sell to people who are members.
And that the amount of co-ops that exist just aren't large enough to make that kind of competitive economy.
So we got a doozy of a topic, and I'm definitely gonna recommend you go to the article itself. It's an exhaustive list of reforms to the mental health system.
15 points.
But they're the type of reforms that would, in essence, abolish it. So when any radical or activist, because sometimes it's getting thrown out in even the mainstream media sometimes, of abolishing prisons, abolishing borders, abolishing the police, what is really meant? So if you change something enough that it is fundamentally different in purpose, in its practice, and how it does things, it is different. It is a different thing. You have abolished the first thing and created something new out of the shell, or just the idea that, say, the police protect people, that the mental health system is to heal. And so this article starts out, so it's called How Would We Know If We Overthrew the Mental Health System? So it kind of gives these bullet points of things that overthrow the current system, but through, like, if we changed each of these areas, it would be fundamentally different. It would be, the old system would be gone, we'd have a new system. And it starts by kind of using the word anti-psychiatry movement. Now, when anti-psychiatry comes up, maybe you think of Scientology or some other kind of pseudo-scientific junk.
Really the Icarus Project.
That's its organization, right?
Yeah.
Icarus Project. But actually what their goal is to point out that psychiatry and the mental health system is actually, that's the pseudo-scientific system.
Right.
And this is something that needs to actually be propagated, because it is, in fact, very reasonable to point this out. It just needs to be said and explained. So, and some of these points will do that. I think I mentioned this in a previous episode, but perhaps it wasn't recorded. Reform is like a jail cell with pretty wallpaper. We don't need mental health reform. We need total abolition of force and coercion. The system doesn't just have problems. It is the problem.
We don't just need an abolition of force and coercion. I mean, we also need an organization of connection.
Mm-hmm. It's what we would have instead.
Right.
Point one is no one would be deemed incompetent. So this is about going beyond the terms of incompetence or what have you.
Unable to make decisions.
Mentally ill as a legal term. And to mean unable to make decisions. But even those who need care can and should and must make their own decisions. They have bodily autonomy. These are things we care about. The ability to have cognitive liberty. To not be restricted. And to only be restricted when one's actions are harmful, right? That's the usual ethical constraint. And to go beyond terms and the actual law of mentally ill. Right? The fact that such a designation exists within the law in letter, spirit, and execution makes the mental health system, and by extension our whole society, intrinsically unjust and oppressive, because someone will always be designated as mentally ill. Truly overthrowing the mental health system, as opposed to just forcing it to be more subtle or rebrand it, to use different words than mentally ill, because that's what points out that the law still uses mentally ill.
Yeah.
So, and even if you change that word, if the law is still saying, oh, if someone is blank, they can be locked up and they can be or detained without reason or trial or charge, under the presumption that they are a danger to others, which is like thought crime or pre-crime, or at least. Number two, this is one I like. All psychiatry programs in all schools would be replaced with what's called MAD studies or neurodivergent study programs. So this is about changing the education away from psychiatry, which is in essence a pseudoscience, to actually studying actual neuroscience and people.
Yeah.
Right? And all drug research would be put into the proper medical category. So there's usually psychiatric drugs. Well, no, those are just drugs. They should be studied by doctors, not people, psychiatrists who do not have a medical degree and do not need to know how the body works, which is why you get all these side effects, perhaps. Number three, MAD and neurodivergent people would be managers, not peer specialists.
Yeah. Well, it just means to the organization of the mental health care system as opposed to being consultants.
Which is a democratizing of workplaces and institutions. So usually it's when you're describing something chaotic, our society has the phrase, the insane are running the asylum.
Yeah.
And this is actually what is being suggested, that just as you as a citizen want the country to be run by people who represent you, who are you, who are like you. Not people who say they have your interests at heart, because they cannot.
People who can interpret your decisions and behavior. And
so it's simply saying that even partially, institutions, mental health hospitals, and so on, should be partially or if completely run by people who either have been treated there, have conditions, and are neurodivergent, and so on. Peer support is others who are not like you telling you what's best for you.
Yep.
That's what essentially is what we have.
Yep.
Number four, and you can do this. You can do this one, Colin. You like this?
Crisis hotlines. Yes. Crisis hotlines would be prohibited from tracking callers or dialing law enforcement without the caller's consent. That would certainly, if that aspect of mental health care was gone, that would indicate a much different system.
What's the current status quo with crisis
currently
hotlines?
The status quo is that if you call a crisis hotline, the call is tracked, and then they know your location, and they also contact law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's actually the norm throughout the psychiatric and social work field. Mm-hmm. Like the SAFE Act here in New York, it obligates psychiatrists and social workers to contact police if their clients meet certain criteria.
Yeah. If they say certain,
I mean, my personal experience is that I've never called a crisis hotline myself because I knew that would only escalate whatever situation I'm going to.
Right.
It would mean I would be taken into a crisis center and then hospitalized.
We have many instances of people being shot by the police because they're
stories all the time
crisis
about
calls.
Yes, people who are, in a sense, you know, I'm trying to put this lightly, but going out of your minds when you're going mad, when you're in an episode and you're incoherent, and there's so much stigma associated with being in one of those states that everyone thinks that you're a danger.
Right.
When in fact you're just having a really bad time, you're just dealing with a lot of stuff going on in your head. You don't want, and when I was in those situations, I didn't want the cops called on me. I mean, the only times that's happened in my life a couple times is when somebody else called a crisis line on my behalf and said, "Can you send someone here?" And in those instances, one of the people that were always sent were the police to drag me away, which is why
not even people in white coats.
No, they would send a specialist, and their job was just to talk me out of the building safely. And then once you're out of the building, there's the officers with the handcuffs, and there's the ambulance to take you into the ER.
Another part of this is Facebook's crisis response system. Do not tell Facebook that your friends are in crisis, because the last thing that someone in crisis needs is to have to deal with soulless corporate concern. Don't do that to your friends.
Is this something that has happened recently in your community?
Oh, it happens a lot. Yeah.
People in crisis mode will go to social media and share their thoughts, and it'll be pretty clear that they're in crisis, and what they really need is someone to talk to and someone to listen to them.
Yeah, they need connection.
Not someone to take them away and shove them in a psychiatric ward.
Yeah, I think that was sometimes the cause of such, Manning.
Manning?
Chelsea Manning had a recent suicide attempt.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
I don't think sending her back to prison is the
solution
there. So, let's see. Next is about community living and basically providing housing with no strings attached. Usually housing is provided with strings attached, meaning you need to take your pills, you need to do whatever we say, we got to lock the door, and that's another different issue. But
yes, you can't have any alcohol.
I'm gonna.
In some places, you have to consent to extremely violating searches, like body searches and...
Mm-hmm. As if you are. I mean, even criminals should not have to deal with this. People in prison. But prison abolitions, hashtag. But let's just say your standard is, prisoners are crimers. But if you have a mental illness, I'm just going to use that, are you to be treated as if you are some murderer?
Yeah, you're treated as a potential violent criminal.
Right.
Potential.
You know.
Again, thought crime. Or just pre-crime, that you're treating someone as guilty when they are not. Service providers would be trained to consider, number six, service providers would be trained to consider doing nothing as a valid option.
Yeah.
Now, this is very interesting as far as, usually you got to do something. Usually there's negative retreating, positive attacking, but there's also the neutral of doing nothing.
Yeah, sometimes you just got to let... Sometimes the episode will pass with time. If you don't prod the person going through the episode, you won't trigger an extended episode.
I think this is the case with seizures, too. Just make sure that they are face up and not, hurting themselves.
That's right.
Yeah, number seven is kind of group with it, that any kind of housing, let's say it's a mental health hospital, whatever, would be unlocked all the time. But... instead, you have, you're locked, those seeking treatment are locked in a room.
Right.
Which is kind of distressing, even on its own.
Feeling stuck in a location is very triggering to some people.
Feeling like you
can't get out of somewhere and move. Like, even if it's in the middle of the night, you just got to get out and move around.
Let's say it's a claustrophobic episode.
Yeah.
Is the answer putting them in a room? A padded room?
Yeah.
Well, and it's also a torture device.
Confinement is always violent.
Yeah, I was in an institution when I was 14 or 15, and the room's only locked from the outside, and you could be punished by being locked in your room for days.
Days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was once for not eating a pea.
As a teenager, every number eight, moving along briskly, every care unit would be funded in a way that decreases the length of stay and gives visitors the drugs they want. So this falls under the, if we have a single payer system and we don't have for-profit insurance, then there is no incentive to keep people longer than they need to be, as many regular physical hospitals do.
And it
falls under those problems.
It's when you're in one of those beds, you're making a company money.
Yeah.
Well, and also it kind of subtly says something here. It gives visitors the drugs they want. Mm-hmm. Largely the health problems that come, health and social problems that come with drug use are because of the criminalization of it. Mm-hmm. Are because you might have to resort to illegal means of acquiring them or...
It gets into that.
Yep.
Adverse drug effects would be independently studied, which they are not currently, because most drugs are created by corporations who have an interest listed, financial interest, listed on the box, because some drugs do not list all of their side effects on the box. But also need to be discussed without taboo.
And this comes after the ninth point, which is that all drugs would be legalized, including prescription drugs.
Yep.
Is that bad?
Because it makes the point.
Number nine, all drugs legalized, or in my case, decriminalized.
Well, this section of the article makes the point that prescription drugs are actually also fall under the category of illegal drugs.
Yeah.
Because if you have a prescription drug in your possession, but your name isn't on the bottle, it's an illegal drug. And if you try to sell it to someone else, that's a criminal act.
Right.
That's kind of, you know, we would be in a totally different scenario if, as it describes in the article, if a doctor, instead of prescribing a drug for you to take and then you take and get the prescription filled from behind the pharmacy counter, it's a kind of a radical notion, and it's one that we should explore. What if a doctor simply said, here's what I recommend, you know? And then you go and get that off the shelf.
Here are the risks of some other things, but here are some lists.
Here's what to think about. Here's the dosage you should have and when you should take it, and then do what works for you.
Well, and also, I mean, food can have as severe adverse effects and as commonly as drugs. And, I mean, food is, in fact, far more chemically complex than drugs are. So...
We have all those peanut, gluten, and so on labeling slowly being added to each package.
Yeah. Managing the risk just has to be a matter of informing people.
Informed consent is the only real consent.
Yes.
As the article says. Number 11, every program that recommends drugs would also offer support for quitting them. Now, many doctors, psychiatrists, will prescribe drugs knowing that they are addictive and sometimes that there is no safe way of withdrawing off of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been the case with a friend of mine who, at the moment, is trying to go clean, but he isn't sick enough to be admitted to rehab.
Mm.
Like, he wants to detox. Sorry, not rehab, but detox. So just detox. Facility.
He hasn't reached the threshold where his life is in danger.
Yeah, he's on probation from his job, but that's apparently not bad enough. But he had a relapse, and he's had drug problems because he was prescribed a bunch of anti-anxiety and depression, whatever, when he was young, 14 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like the guy that other teenagers went to for pills. So he became kind of a ad hoc drug dealer.
That gets you into the game.
And that meant that if he wants to quit, there's a lot of people that are going to be upset with him. Like, and they ask him constantly, oh, I hear you have drugs. Can you sell some to me? And
again, if all the drugs were legal and you could get them off the counter.
And the regulations that are to prevent pill pushing, let's call it that, or legal, you know, on street pill pushing, makes it harder for him to actually get the drugs he actually does need to, you know, stay sane.
Mm-hmm.
So any program that can give you drugs need to provide the detox too. Number 12.
This one is interesting.
All psychiatric diagnoses would be, I hinted at this when we started, would be recognized as bunk and removed from medical records.
Yeah.
Because all psychiatry, DSM, everything in the DSM is in fact pseudoscience. It's not based on actual, it's not based on any physical evidence. Now, there is an exception here where it mentions that Down syndrome is caused by a biological cause.
Almost everything else, we're not sure yet.
Yeah,
we're not sure
what causes it.
Like, I've been
diagnosed.
I've been diagnosed bipolar. I'm not real. We don't know what causes it. We don't know if it's
those drug ads make it seem like, oh, we know it's an imbalance of chemicals in our pills.
Yeah, no. I do like in this point where it says categories such as multiplicity, hearing voices, or autistic would be recognized as cultural identities.
Mm.
I mean, and yeah, that goes for almost any neurodiversity, mental illness, or disability.
Yeah.
When people with those things in common connect with each other, we find we have like a pre-existing foundation for community just because our sensory experiences are so related.
And remember that things like homosexual disorder,
yes, that sentence continues.
Yeah. Other identities were in the DSM until they weren't.
Yeah.
And that's not the evolution of your normal scientific inquiry where we find out more.
Right.
That was because there were social movements where these communities said, can you stop telling us we're wrong, that we don't fit?
Ultimately, the reasons that homosexual disorder were in the DSM were not scientific. They were religious. Mm-hmm. Totally cultural. I mean, I kind of like that. This is the first time I've encountered this idea. And I mean, I'm still pretty strongly invested into the idea that I've got a mental illness, right? I kind of have to agree with this stuff. But as if it were a cultural identity.
Because the system says
What if I'm just, you know, a moody guy who kind of has mood swings and has strong emotional responses to things, is creative and thinks real fast sometimes, and other times, and then gets down. You know what I mean? I mean, that doesn't really fit with the way that the capitalists want me to work, right? It's really hard to be able to work with that. But what if they worked with me?
So I'm just going to cut us, go to our last break. I can't believe we actually got through most of it. The last two are pretty much just make force illegal.
Three more points.
And institute and universal basic
and consent. Consent.
Yes, consent. Very important. Ableism. So take it away, Isaac, in our last section here.
Just one last comment on the previous section. There's a culture of pop psychology and psychiatry where it's people think it's okay to diagnose someone without consent, called armchair diagnosing. You know, that's the Trump is a narcissist. Trump is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's not okay.
No. We need to explain what's wrong with him.
That's extremely unethical. That's an ethical violation that professionals lose their licenses over. It is not okay for the public to do.
I have a little story about that. So I used to follow on Facebook a group called The Christian Left.
Oh, yeah.
And they were posting all this stuff about how Donald Trump is a narcissist and has some kind of selfishness disorder. And I went on there and I said, look, I don't like Trump. I'm a leftist. I'm also kind of Christian spiritually.
That's why I'm on this site.
And I said, I'm not on this site for ableist crap. Like, Donald Trump, his problem is he's a spoiled, rich bastard.
He represents what's wrong with he represents
what's wrong with the ruling class. And there are tons of people. This is not a narcissistic personality disorder thing. You guys are being ableist. And what happened? What did the Christian left do to me?
He got banned.
Those liberals banned me.
Yeah.
For concern trolling. And I was like, well, now we see that this is just one of the prime examples of how a lot of spaces that call themselves left are actually centrist liberals and quite ableists.
Well, rather, discriminatory centrist liberals are usually ableists. So let's talk about what it even means. Oh, you know, because let's say your mainstream guy's reaction is like, oh, another thing I need to worry about not being. It's bad enough I have to worry about not being racist, transphobic, homophobic.
Yeah, stop and being now ableist.
You have to worry about being a decent human being.
Not being a jerk.
You have to worry about being responsible for how your actions affect other people.
Whoa, guys, I'm feeling attacked as being a normative guy.
Well, and like Isaac said, you have to be responsible for your actions, and this is an important philosophical point. Mm-hmm. Saying something is action, right? Mm-hmm. There are literal sound waves being moved. There are muscles moving in your, you know, language. Yeah. Saying something is taking action. And I say that in the context of, like, you know, speaking out isn't doing anything.
People
who want more direct action.
Yeah. It goes to questions of self-control to say, it's like, I can't help using the words we're going to talk about and being ableist. I can't help it.
Sure,
you're telling me to, and I'm being hypothetical here. Hypothetical normative guy.
We know.
You're asking me to change who I am by not using certain words. Yeah. And that's a personal attack. And thus, you're the fascist.
Right. Except, I mean, those words have a very high cost. There's, you know...
Tell me about it.
I would invite anyone listening to go to disability-memorial.org. And, you know,
Sounds like a monument we should actually have in our squares, victims of ableism.
Yeah. I would like to read a few of the the individuals listed there. Johnny McFadden, 19, unspecified disability, died of neglect with malnutrition and severe bed sores. Jordan Rodriguez, 5, developmentally disabled, nonverbal. Jordan's mother would not take him to doctors. The exact cause of his death is unknown, but believed to be cumulative effects of abuse. His mother and her boyfriend buried him in their backyard. Aubrey and Luke Dawson, 9. Luke loved sports and played basketball, baseball, and soccer. Bree wanted to be a nurse like her mom. She liked learning about medicine. They were shot by their father, who feared they would inherit his depression. He then committed suicide. Carolyn Croucher, bedridden in hospice care. Vanessa Danielson, 36, multiple sclerosis. Antonio DiStasio, 4, autistic. These three died in such horrific ways that I cannot read them. So, but they, for people who want to read that,
explore that.
It's at disabilitymemorial.org.
Yeah.
These words have an effect. There's words build a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And and in our culture, everyone is reminded several times a day that to be an idiot, to be crazy, stupid, lame, dumb, an imbecile, insane, a fool, a moron, psycho, retarded, is to be beyond help, and therefore to deserve whatever happens to us.
Yeah, that's right.
These are words that strip us of any right to control our own lives. This is where we lose the agency. These are the words that make people believe that we have no capacity to make decisions about our own lives. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we use them all the time. And yeah. I did.
We use them far too often in our political language.
Lunatic, maniac, just saying madhouse, midget, mogoloid, morbidly obese, moronic, nuts, psycho. You use psycho. Simpleton, spaz, especially abled, stupid, suffers from blank,
I think we have
yeah.
Enough of a list, but I'd like to finish this.
Go ahead.
I mean, you don't have to mean any harm for your actions to be part of this injustice.
Yep.
You might avoid stepping on ants when you see them, but there will be more ants you tread on because you didn't see them. And people are not seeing us. This is why the rallying cry of disability and mental illness self-advocacy is nothing about us without us. Other people have the liberty of ignoring the effect their actions have on us precisely because of this violence. We're literally erased and pushed to the margins of society so that we don't have to, so that we won't be hurt.
Mm-hmm. So many are caught up worrying about where they're getting their next meal or how they're going to pay rent, that when the inconvenience of someone who is disabled comes along, it's just, I don't have the energy to deal with this.
Yep.
Or a businessman says, I don't have the budget because the bank won't give me the money for wheelchair ramps. They'll give me just enough of the loan to make the profit that I can guarantee.
I don't want to hire someone who only has 20 hours a week.
Good week.
In a good week, you know?
Since lead is a major disabling factor, it's like Elon Musk putting filters in people's homes instead of talking to the city and replacing pipes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to go through, because it's really important. So it's like, well, what am I supposed to say if I can't call Trump crazy? Well, I have a list.
You're supposed to call him wrong.
Just as long as our ableist terms list.
Call him evil?
Bad.
Evil
would work. I mean, Trump is evil. I mean, this is...
Evil's kind of... But evil.
Fascism is evil.
I have a problem with evil because it's like this intrinsic... badness that isn't caused.
No,
like
you're
this.
Right. Moral judgments aren't helpful either.
It's moralizing. So here's some other words, though, that if you don't like something and you want to be crass about it. Asinine, bad, bleak, boring, bullish, callous, careless, confusing, contemptible, coward, crappy, dense, devoid of...
Well,
you have a problem with some of those?
Yeah, devoid of often is, like, on the fence.
Cool. Disgusting, dull, enraging, evils used. Extremist, problematic.
That would work for fascism.
Furious. Gross is used a lot.
Also.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Ignoramus.
No, ignoramus and ignorant are judgments on intelligence.
Sure.
So that's not...
Impolite.
This is still...
Yeah.
This list is not exhaustive.
Some of these lack a punch, though. So let's see. Jerk. There's jerk.
Donald Trump is a jerk.
The mean...
He's obtuse.
Nefarious.
Often he is nonsensical. I mean...
Obtuse.
Can't outrageous. Understand what the guy is saying.
Overwrought. Pathetic. I like pathetic.
Paradoxical is on there.
Putrid.
And that's a good one for fascism as well.
Rude.
Yeah, I mean, paradoxical. Paradox is inherent in everything. That's
uninspired, unoriginal, vapid.
We have
vapid,
tyrannical
like
on there. Vomit-inducing.
Spurious.
Things that are two syllables. You know, you want those punchy two-syllable words.
That's actually good. Putrid.
So here are some words to use when describing those with disabilities. You can say disabled. That's good. With a chronic health condition. Neuroatypical. Neurodivergent. Has a chronic health condition. So using condition. For describing people on the autism spectrum. Autistic person. People with autism. Or Aspie for a nickname.
And or Audie.
So on. And impossible replacement insults. And it kind of leaves a blank, and you can fill it in with whatever you can come up with. So, this has been the Three Left Show. We are on iTunes now. You can get us on iTunes in podcast form. There is also an RSS link. That means you take this link, you put it into any podcast app. You can get that link on our website, threelefts.news. That's threelefts.news. We have a Facebook page, Three Left Show, and Patreon page where you can support us with monthly donations that will go towards supporting this station and making it better and upgrading our equipment and software and what have you.